we have scheduled a forum about the World Council of Churches, because a lot of us are curious about it, and because we're lucky enough to have four people here who have been there in one capacity or another. And we arranged the forum so that each of them can talk a little bit about some of their impressions, and then we can have time for you to ask questions and dialogue with them. And I am the watchkeeper, timekeeper, and they know that when I look real ugly, it's time to think about drawing this portion to a close. And we thought that we'd start, actually Phil, I'm going to have Mildred just kick off for a second, and tell us why is it we need and have the World Council, and then, then I'll tell you. Okay.
The World Council of Churches serves as a servant of churches. And in this capacity, it calls the churches to the goal of visible unity in one faith and in one Eucharistic fellowship. Later on, a person is going to share impressions or reflections from the Lima document and that Eucharistic fellowship that was experienced. It helps to facilitate the common witness of the churches in each place and in all places. It supports efforts at common witness and evangelism. It expresses a concern for the service of human need and promotion of justice and peace, and it fosters the renewal of churches in unity, worship, mission, and service. In this regard, the World Council of Churches has many different tasks to perform, and among the tasks, they come together, I think it's every 6 years, and assembles, is it 7 years, and deal with the issues that are at hand. Some of the issues that were dealt with this year were witnessing in a divided world, taking steps toward unity, moving toward participation, healing and sharing life in community, confronting threats to peace and survival. They have a central committee composed of 145 persons who work in various ways in coming up with recommendations related to these issues. Each of us has a specific focus that we want to share in order to give you a glimpse of how WCC functions.
The person you've just been listening to, I meant to introduce. Now, this is Mildred Drinkert, who is a theological student in Washington, D.C., but also has been an educator and went to the World Council of Churches as a part of, can you name the group for me?
It was the Theological Students Conference of the United States and of Canada,
which was just running simultaneously with the World Council. Phil Erlander is here. He's a pastor in Colorado Springs, and Phil has some impressions.
When you plan your vacation, when you're in Colorado coming to the Pacific Northwest, and you have a certain dates that you're working with, we tried to figure out a little bit what we're going to do with those times we had as one of our intended places to visit was Holden Village, beginning on August 1st, and we were going to come out about a week and a half early, and we tried to figure out, for instance, where should we go to church on Sunday? And so we just thought we'd run up to Vancouver and worship with the World Council and stay one extra day on Monday. And I have no previous experience with the World Council, and I was there a total of a day and a half, so I'm now considered to be an expert in the World Council churches. But it was an amazing experience to come onto the campus of the University of British Columbia, and then to see in the middle of the campus a huge circus tent. And that was, in a sense, the center of the whole World Council of Churches, in the sense that that's where all the worship was held. And we got there about an hour early, and already groups were gathering into the tent, preparing for the communion service. And we found out afterwards that this was the first time that the World Council in General Assembly had communed together. So it was truly an historic time to be there as a vacation worship experience. I was impressed as I walked into the tent and saw the flags of all of the countries of the world that are represented by the Church Council on three of the sides. The other side was where you come in was all open. And then the three sides of the tents had all the flags. It was just amazing to realize in that sense how many nations of the world are represented in the World Council. And then to see the people gather for that service, and to just see by dress and other signs of how people look, that you could tell that this was a worldwide gathering, and people wore some of their own dress from their nations. And there was a tremendous diversity in terms of the people gathered there. And it really gave me a sense of how large and diverse the church really is, especially when I compare it to my own situation in Colorado Springs, which is, I suppose, 99.44% white middle class. And to realize that that's a very limited view or perspective of the church, and to be there that particular Sunday was just an eye-opener for me to see the worldwide church gathered under the roof of one tent. Some other ways that diversity showed was in language. Before each worship service, the music would be rehearsed, and the whole congregation was invited to participate in that worship. Well, most of the worship leaders spoke English, but there was French-speaking worship leader who, when he got up, he spoke only in French and was giving complicated instructions on this group was supposed to sing this and this and this, and then he'd start to direct it, but nobody would exactly do what he had said because hardly anybody spoke or understood French. But anyway, that didn't seem to bother him. It didn't seem to bother the congregation because everybody just kind of got into it and started to sing, kind of like what we did in Vespers tonight.
Right.
Then it was quite an experience to pray the Lord's Prayer in your own native language, and to realize that English was a minority as the Lord's Prayer was prayed. You listen around you and you just hear all kinds of languages being used during the praying of the Lord's Prayer. Then I was also impressed with the diversity in terms of children, and a very very special place for children in the World Council. The first issue area on witness included, as I attended the plenary session the next Monday morning, and you had to get a ticket way ahead of time to get into it. We sent in $5 and got tickets to go and be observers on this one particular day. And you look out on the floor of this huge gymnasium and you see all the tables with the names of the countries on them. The USA way in the far back corner because it was done alphabetically. But it also gave you a sense that USA was not the power that controlled everything in the World Council. And I think we have to realize that we are a minority in the world as Christians. We cannot control the World Council of Churches by any stretch of the imagination. But this particular day we were there, the issues were presented. And this first issue, the first thing it talks about is children. The children of the world and how important children are and how we need to involve children. Well, the communion liturgy the day before had used children as part of the assistance on that particular day. So I was just totally overwhelmed, in a sense, by the tremendous diversity. And to see that, the church in its diversity.
Paints the picture well. Tom Witt went up from Holden. Tom's been here how long now?
Over 2 years.
Okay. Why don't you tell a little about what you do?
Okay, I've been on the staff here for just over 2 years as the winter program director. Early this summer, I was fortunate enough to get 6 or 7 weeks away from Holden to participate in a Lutheran peace study seminar to Europe, to West Germany, East Germany, and then our group went to Czechoslovakia, Poland, and the Soviet Union. Returned from there to Holden on about the 20th of July and was able to attend the World Council for 3.5 days as a guest of Lutheran World Ministries, who, along with Lutheran Peace Fellowship, was one of the sponsors of the trip that I went on. And part of the purpose of my attending the World Council was to make more contacts, explain to people about my trip, and also to see people that I had seen in Europe, particularly Czechoslovakia and the German Democratic Republic, and those who I'd seen in Hanover. So it was good to see some people that I had met a month earlier. But because I had been on the peace seminar, and because peace is an interest of mine, I'm going to talk about the peace and justice emphasis at the World Council, or at least what I know of it. I'm also not an expert on the World Council of Churches, and this was my first time ever associated with the council. But I also attended three plenary sessions, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. Phil was there on Monday. Thursday happened to be the day that the World Council reviewed the first draft statement on peace and justice. Again, the World Council, this is a big deal because they only meet once every 7 years. So the draft was handed out on Wednesday to all of the delegates, and I was fortunate enough to get a copy of one on that day. But they're handed out in all languages. The communication there was tremendous. I think someone else is going to talk about the language barriers, but the way that things were communicated. But everyone got a copy and was able to read it beforehand. And then on Thursday morning, it was presented by someone who had worked on the draft and then discussed at large. And I think what I'll do is read a few sentences from the statement and let it speak for itself. First of all, a little bit of background. I think the emphasis on peace and justice at the World Council became very apparent to me early on, that there would be no discussion of the peace issue at the World Council without a discussion about justice, the gap between North and South, rich and poor, that had to be part of any discussion of the nuclear arms race. And this was primarily brought to the attention of the Western and Northern churches by the churches from the Third World. In a speech given by Alan Busack from South Africa, he said, let me quote from here in the WCC paper. He gave a warning early on in the assembly, which I did not hear, but I read about, that peace movements in the North and in the West and in the East as well could become ideologies of oppression if they are separated from the justice concerns of the South. And that was a very strong warning beginning of the assembly, and I think in their statement they took that in consideration. Three-page document, I'll just read a few sentences. The title of it, this was one of the issues that came up very early, the title was No Peace Without Justice. And peace cannot be built on foundations of injustice, but peace requires a new international order based on justice for and in all nations, and respect for the God-given humanity and dignity of every person. The churches today are called to a new confession of their faith, to repentance for the times when we have remained silent in the face of injustice or threats to peace. The biblical vision of peace with justice for all, of wholeness, of unity for all God's people is not one of several options for the followers of Christ, but it is an imperative in our time. The statement goes on and talks about the growing threats to justice and peace, including racism and the systemic violence that comes along with the arms race. The intersection of East-West and North-South conflicts has resulted in greater injustice, systematic violations of human rights, oppression, homelessness, starvation, war, and death for increasing millions each year all over the world. The ecumenical approach for peace and justice is based on the belief that without justice for everywhere, for all everywhere, we will never have peace anywhere. Continues and talks about arms trade and weapons trade and proliferation and the effect on the world economy. I'll move to the stronger statements in the first draft. All nations now possessing nuclear weapons or capable of doing so in the foreseeable future should unequivocally renounce policies of first use as an immediate step toward building confidence. It's one of the appeals of the statement. Another one that I thought was particularly strong, the production and deployment of nuclear weapons as well as their use constitute a crime against humanity and therefore there should be a complete halt in the production of nuclear weapons and in weapons research and development in all nations to be enforced through a treaty. Such a position supports the struggle to cause one's own nation to commit itself never to own or use a nuclear weapon, despite the period of nuclear vulnerability, to persuade Christians and others to refuse to cooperate with or accept employment in any projects related to nuclear weapons and nuclear warfare. So they call into question any testing of nuclear bombs, the dumping nuclear waste, of wars right now, of oppression, and repression, which threatens survival. Very last paragraph I will read. Again, they're restating what they stated 7 years ago in Nairobi, that the churches have to emphasize their readiness to live without the protection of armaments, and that the deployment as well as the use of nuclear weapons is a crime against humanity and must be condemned on ethical and theological grounds. And the statement says, we are now further convinced that Christians should give witness to their refusal to participate in any conflict involving weapons of mass destruction or indiscriminate effect. After that was presented, there was discussion, and I just want to say quickly that out of maybe the 20 or so people from the whole assembly that spoke to the document, there were maybe three that seriously called into question or opposed certain parts of it, specifically the last part. And of those three, one was from Great Britain, and the other two were Bishop Crumbly of the Lutheran Church of America and Bishop Preuss of the American Lutheran Church, both opposing the last part of that statement because it implied a commitment to unilateral disarmament. So for whatever that's worth, I still agree with Phil that I was very aware that we are, in America, a minority of the church, and I don't know what will come out of it. Their considerations, their comments were taken into consideration, as well as those from the third world that asked for certain parts of the statement to be stronger, especially in relation to the justice issue.
Okay. Mildred, we'll come back to you now.
Okay. I just want to say something about what Tim has said. I write poetry quite often, and the World Council to me represented the true family of God, with people coming from all walks of life, with diverse cultures, with different languages, and yet with a kind of oneness or an essence or an aura that let you know that they were about God's work in the world. Now, for me, that was probably the most significant, visible and and perception that I had, or feeling perception. And of course, when I heard persons from France or from Germany or from Africa stand up and say, Chairperson, I will speak in my language, or I will speak in German, English, in my, you know, it was like an insistence on being who they are as God's people, unique, with all of the gifts that they would bring to the World Council. And that was really a very fine process for me to be a part of, to flip my little dial to the different languages and to be aware of the nuances in communicating that are essential for global understandings. Another real strong impression for me was not only the Eucharist, using a document that had been worked on by people from all over the world, so that there was some common understanding about kneeling at the Lord's table, but the Greek Orthodox service was significant. They had a very spiritual service the last Sunday that I was there with bishops from all over the world in that tradition. I guess at the Greek Orthodox service, they had prepared a booklet for us about this thick. It took about an hour and a half for the service. We stood practically the whole hour and a half. Of course, for the first time in life, my Greek became sensible. I sang Greek hymns and read many of the responses in Greek. So that was meaningful for me. On the Saturday night before I left, there was a prayer vigil or peace vigil all night long. Bishop Tutu from Africa was one of those keynoters, as was Philip Potter, who is the chairperson of that council. I guess the other thing that was significant for me, for the whole group, was Coretta Scott King's presence. It was not necessarily in the words that she said, because that was my first time experiencing Coretta King in person, but it was the feeling that was there with 5,000 people standing and singing "We Shall Overcome," and with the spirit that was felt in that room as those persons joined in that common melody. With the student, theological students conference, I want to say something about that. I met students from Newfoundland, from Nova Scotia, from all over Canada, from Harvard, from Lutheran schools in Minnesota. Of course, we had a person from Gettysburg Seminary. And we came together to share our common concerns. And one of our common concerns was that quite frequently, and this was a concern of the World Council of Churches, we do a lot of preaching the word and theologizing, but there's very little of doing the word, actually making the word incarnate, making it an active part of our lives. The other thing that we talked about in that whole regard was how do we get community development projects so that people are really involved and don't have to be intimidated in doing that kind of thing for ministry in a world where there is great need. We had directors of theological associations to come and talk with us about our schools and how a theology for a new day needs to be created in our schools. And one of the actions of that conference was that Canadian students and United States students would develop, well, we organized a task force for continued meeting of those groups. I attended issue sessions on human justice where persons spoke. And I just want to tell you a story or two from some of those sessions. And people of Native Americans, persons from South Africa, Black Americans, women from Europe, women from India spoke. One of the women, Domitilia, from Bolivia, was very feeling and articulate about the needs of her people and how she lives in a country that has rich resources, and yet those resources are raped from that country, and her people are extremely poor, and their health is poor, and the influence of all of the materialistic values and the rape of that country and the violence to the people and its influence on her children and the children's lives. That same story was told by Native Americans. It was told by people who lived in New York, perhaps around the Love Canal. It was told by women from India in terms of the oppressive kinds of conditions that they experienced. There seemed to be evolving a kind of solidarity with persons who are poor and oppressed, and you would see those conditions even expressed in the United States. We don't like to talk about how that oppression expresses itself in this culture, but that same kind of oppression exists here. So I was really touched by the testimonies of a woman, for example, from the South Pacific, who told about how her whole village was displaced, the health problems that had come, the kinds of edicts that come from the U.S. government that her people can't read. A way of debasing the dignity of persons was felt by all of us as these testimonies were given. Probably my own awareness of the need to take the gospel, which is from through the eyes of the poor and the oppressed, seriously, was strongly imprinted in my mind. The whole area of women's rights were explored in terms of language and in terms of oppressive conditions. And one of the things that women need to do, Lutheran women, Methodist women, whatever kind of women, they need to come together and discuss their perspective of the gospel and what is fullness of life for them. The conference had a place called The Well, and it was a campus ministry by the Lutheran Church where we just dealt with all kinds of issues, women's issues, and that was a real ministry. It was a great experience for me. It was like an opening to the world, whatever negative publicity is given for the World Council of Churches, I think a person has to experience what happens in terms of global, love and global connectedness.
I want to share a few impressions, and then related again to the Eucharist that I shared on Sunday. Phil already mentioned this, but I want to just say a few things about that service. We sing in our liturgy, give us a foretaste of the feast to come, the coming kingdom of God, and I don't think I'll ever be closer to the coming kingdom of God than I was at that Eucharist, to be surrounded in this tent from people from all over the world, all of their languages, and the Lima liturgy, bringing in the music of the whole world, the Archbishop of Canterbury, the celebrant, and then next to him, a Danish Lutheran woman minister as the assisting minister, surrounded by assistants from all over the world to bring the sacrament of the bread and the wine, and then to share the bread and wine, to share the creed with all the different languages again. That I had a vision there, and it was this that I've said before, but it has never been felt for me in a more powerful way, is that I am a Christian first, and this is my family, and I'm an American second. My first family on this earth is my brothers and sisters in the faith around the world. And I really think this is something the Reader's Digest has never sensed. And they don't understand, because they think the World Council of Churches should be a little American organization. Well, that's, I wish they could have been there at that worship service. They would have felt something that is, and I looked around and I saw so many tears in so many eyes. So many people were seeing the vision that this is the kingdom of God. To be with people of every race and nation almost on earth together, worshiping Christ. A little sense of this too, on Tuesday night I was able to crash a dinner. 250 were invited, 320 came. It was a salmon dinner provided by Lutheran Brotherhood Insurance, so I didn't feel too guilty. But it was for all the Lutherans who were at the World Council. And again, the same sense of eating together with here now Lutheran Christians from all over the world. At my table, there were some of us from the United States, a pastor from Iceland, next to me, a surgeon from Tanzania. It was emotional as each nation was called and the people from that nation stood up and received an applause. You know, and when the delegation of Lutherans from Namibia stood up, the sense of the suffering of these people, and now they are here with us. Those from Ethiopia, the other really persecuted church of our Lutheran family. But I think when I felt the deepest was when the Lutherans from the Soviet Union stood up, and I think they received the longest applause. And the thought came to me, our missiles are aimed at them. And this is sin. And I had a sense that they are my family first. Those are some impressions, and I just think I was so lucky that we set aside this time to, I guess I call it heaven for a few moments on this earth. And that might be,
Have any questions and comments to offer?
Did any of you get a sense of any controversy?
Oh yes.
And can you? I mean, I heard a little bit of that from what Tom was saying about the debate of the peace issue. And I'm wondering, where else was there controversy within the gathering of council, and about what, and who? Who took what side?
I'd like to speak to two areas. Many persons who are hungry spoke about the fact that daily millions of their people are dying, and that the fact that the council should deal with justice in relationship to them and human dignity before it deals with peace. And this was an issue that Europe and North America was really pushing toward. So the witnesses from these two sectors were just constantly like this. There was a tension throughout the assembly between whether there should be justice and human dignity or peace as the priority or the major thrust. The other thing that happened at one of the plenary sessions was that youth stood and proclaimed loudly that they had been denied participation rights. There was a lot of controversy, but I just pointed those two. They were given 7 slots, and they wanted something like 13, and they were saying that churches do not recognize youth leadership, and that they are the future church, the same problems we hear in local situations, and they were pleading for church groups throughout the world to give more serious consideration to youth leadership. Those were just two.
Tom,
did you want to comment too? Well, I would just underline, I felt very much the justice and peace tension in whether or not theologically that really is a tension. I don't know. I mean, it might be, but it certainly was discussed quite a bit. And that, conscious of that in the statement, that there would be no peace without justice. So the two were tied together.
The problems of genocide were discussed a great deal. And also helping the persons who there was a great deal of talk about what needs to be done, not just for the one who is oppressed, but what the oppressor needs to do. So there were statements back and forth between those groups in terms of positions that are needed in today's world.
Yes, Mary, what gets done with all these statements and resolutions and things that have passed? I mean, is it just to give a show of solidarity to the world that Christians agree about something, or just go back to nations or congregations, denominations, or what happens?
Dan, can you speak on?
I get the feeling they influence policies for churches in years to come, between the time that assembly meets and the next one. Now, I understand persons are coming in Saturday who have been a part of that assembly for the whole time, and they will have all of the deliberations or the recommendations that have been made. So they will be able to answer the kind of question that you are raising.
I think part of it is that this local congregations that will take the responsibility to study what comes out of the World Council churches, many throughout the world do. I think maybe this is a personal observation, maybe the greatest effect of the World Council of Churches through the years is that gradually it gathers together a unified church to witness to the world. And maybe these statements are part of it. Celebrating Holy Communion together was a momentous step in the unity of the church, I think.
But that's not going to influence us. We're just now getting together with the Episcopalians. Are we going to immediately commune with everybody? Is that what that says, the World Council of Churches?
There was a very strong message in one of the plenary sessions. I can't remember what church this person represented, but he came up and said very firmly, let us not say anything in any statement that is any less or any more than what we are willing to do in our own local churches. And that we really, if we say something here, we are all obligated as church leaders to go back and push for that in our own churches. And I thought that was well said, it needed to be said, because it'd be very easy to say something in the World Council and not do anything afterwards. It's my question in general about church statements. Whatever happens to them, do any of them do any good? This one in particular.
A great deal of testimony came also, and criticism that the World Council of Churches has done
what other bodies, church bodies, do, and that is build a structure, an organizational structure that does not get right down to the local church as it should. Many of the persons who serve on the World Council of Churches are bishops, or they are persons, ordained persons, and the number of lay persons is there. There was a need to increase those and increase youth so that all of this could filter down to local churches. And there was a great deal of discussion on those concerns. And you know, I don't know what mechanism was designed to deal with that.
Related to that, I forgot exactly the context of this, but in many places around the World Council of Churches really is listened to because it's one of the few places in the world that is so representative of people from the entire world almost to get together and speak together. And I think it was in the context of the United Nations lessons. Other people around the world listen because this is so representative.
I'm curious, I went to the opening day assembly, and in order to get into the arena, we had to walk past about, well, at least a couple of hundred Reader's Digest subscribers who were marching with placards telling us that the World Council of Churches was communist and supporting revolution and so forth. And I wondered if they made a big show that first day and then were quiet, or if they had a presence throughout the assembly.
They did not have a presence the rest of the week, to my knowledge.
The press really made a big deal out of that. They almost said it was going to be a religious war. And I think it really kind of fizzled out, probably to the disappointment of the press.
Yeah. I would like just some sense of the variety, not of the peoples, but how time was spent overall. I mean, we've talked about now plenary sessions and debate of issues, worship. Is there not also at an assembly a good bit of time together and study and study and
yes.
So on? I would just like some sense of what it looks like in the round.
Okay, there was an accredited visitors program. And in that program, students received credits for courses in areas like ecumenicity or any of you could register for that program, and they had a session of accredited programs in Bellingham, Washington, as well as in Vancouver. In those programs, there were parallel programs going on at the same time as those study groups for the delegates. Then there was a visitors program. And they had designed a whole series for those persons, and then there were programs for women where they go to the well. Now those were just a few of the programs. Every morning and every night, in fact, three times a day, there was a worship experience. And these worship experiences were multicultural, and sometimes they were just in a specific tradition. In terms of Bible study, that was available. That was one of the areas, just as women's issues. The concept of women's issues ran all through the conference. So if you wanted to really get a full dose on women's issues and get many different perspectives of problems, you could just stay with that the whole time that one would be there in a block of time. There were four blocks of time, really. One in the morning, one in the afternoon, and some kind of evening activity each day.
Let me add to that, so just kind of an impression that there were two basic programs going on at the same time. A lot more than that if you want to really get into detail, but there's the delegates, the official delegates of the churches had a separate schedule that they attended to the whole time. They had to be present every morning on as voting delegates on the floor of the main body. Then in the afternoon, late morning and afternoons, they broke up into small groups that where only delegates could be present. Visitors could not attend those, so that they were in groups of about 20 with diversity from the world to, say, work on some of these issues and work through some of these statements. So that they really were busy as official delegates, and they could not participate in what the other level, which was the visitors program. And so throughout, they had a schedule printed up for visitors, and you could pick out, you know, you think it's hard choosing in Holden. Well, they may have had, say, 15 different things that you could go to at a particular hour. And I attended one morning session that was just the African church. And there were four speakers on a panel from different parts of Africa, and then it was thrown open to questions from the audience, about 200 people, and wow, what a bunch of questions they got. It was just standing in line, and people just chew. But that was the visitors program.
You said that there was a large ovation for the Lutherans from Soviet Union. Were there other Christians from Soviet Union?
Yeah, I was talking about the dinner for Lutherans. Now,
you
could see on the floor, you know, the largest delegation from the Soviet Union would be from the Russian Orthodox Church. The Lutheran would be a real minority in the Soviet Union.
We have, again, a gift of people who are able to transmit so well an experience that we haven't been able to have otherwise. And I'm grateful to all four of you. In fact, before we do anything else, I think we should thank them.